Trend number one, death and resurrection on Wall Street. As we saw in September and October of 2008, Wall Street's old business model was no longer sustainable. Some of the biggest names in finance, like AIG, Bear Stearns, Merrill Lynch, Lehman Brothers, Washington Mutual, Wachovia, and others, were sold off in whole or piecemeal at fire sale prices. Until recently, these companies were some of America's most successful and respected institutions. Unfortunately, their apparent success was built on the shifting sands of excessive leverage and speculation. And as liquidity disappeared from the system, it was quickly apparent that they weren't viable as independent firms. Even America's two remaining traditional investment banks, Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, had to seek reclassification as bank holding companies so they would be eligible for more help from the Federal Reserve. So, what's going to be different now? And what was it about the old business model that led to its demise? As recently explained by economist Robert Samuelson in the Washington Post, the vanquished business model had three components that differed from the more stable model that was in place from 1933 until the 80s. First, investment banks no longer saw themselves primarily as advisors and intermediaries, where they helped clients raise capital and provided advice on mergers and acquisitions. Instead, they took the role of gamblers, buying and selling stocks, bonds, and other securities. Traditional investment banks, as well as commercial banks, moved from serving individual and corporate clients to trading for their own accounts. Second, the business model's compensation scheme encouraged excessive risk-taking. While traders could make huge sums if they generated huge gains, the firm itself was stuck with any losses if they occurred. An employee who lost millions could simply walk away. Base salaries for experienced managing directors were in the $200,000 to $300,000 range, but bonuses were often 5 to 10 times higher. The allure of instant riches, with limited downside, encouraged unrestrained risk-taking. And third, investment banks relied increasingly on maximum leverage to create enormous returns. Leverage was the irresistible temptation. Why? Because extreme leverage creates huge profits, when everything works as planned. And in a world where bonuses were the holy grail, mega-profits produced eye-popping compensation. Take Lehman Brothers as an example. At the end of 2007, it had equity of about $23 billion, but its holdings in securities totaled a whopping $700 billion. That meant its debt-to-equity ratio was 30 to 1. Of course, a fundamental financial principle is that every investment represents a balance between risk and reward. Regrettably, supposedly savvy investment firms focused only on rewards, and pretended risk was an anachronism. That approach worked for years, but eventually the winds of change blew, and big investment firms started to fold up like so much cheap lawn furniture. Stepping back for a moment, we see that such crises are nothing new. In the late 80s, the S&L industry disappeared as both a regional real estate bubble and a junk bond bubble burst at the same time. Then, in 2000, we saw the bursting of the dot-com tech bubble. That was quickly followed by terrorist attacks on September 11, 2001 that closed Wall Street, undermined the airline sector, devastated many elements of tourism, caused unemployment to skyrocket, and led America into two wars. In each of these crises, traders and brokers wore grim looks. Panic was everywhere, and the government stepped in to right the ship. And each time, the fears of disaster proved to be exaggerated. Unfortunately, fixing each crisis laid the foundation for the next one. For example, soon after 9/11, things improved dramatically. The low interest rates put in place by the Fed to offset the effects of 9/11 made mortgage-backed securities the money tree for Wall Street. Investors here and overseas who had once bought tech stocks by the truckload quickly became major fans of collateralized debt obligations, commonly referred to as CDOs. Foolishly, these buyers saw those debt obligations not for what they were, risky derivatives, but as a source of seemingly endless rewards. CDOs became addictive, both for sellers and for buyers. But as we've repeatedly learned, such apparent win-win propositions never endure forever, and many people end up losing. This was no exception. Once housing prices peaked and defaults began to rise, the value of CDOs declined. However, since they were very difficult to value, the market effectively dried up, and in the short term, the value of the riskiest segments, known as tranches, effectively dropped to zero. Mark-to-market accounting rules, put in place in the aftermath of the Enron collapse, required firms to recognize these paper losses on the assets. As a result, hundreds of billions of dollars disappeared from the balance sheets of Wall Street firms in a matter of months. Now we find the U.S. Treasury providing the system with capital. The plan involves taking severely impaired assets off bank balance sheets and providing liquid funds that the banks can lend to businesses and individuals. This is a big part of a broader program to ensure that the credit market meets the needs of the broader economy. So, what's ahead? After more than 25 years of rapid growth and big margins, Wall Street is in for a period of retrenchment that won't be pleasant. Major layoffs have already been announced, and the impact won't just be limited to investment bankers and their staffs. To begin with, the financial meltdown will have serious adverse effects in New York City and New York State, which have lived well off the tax receipts from Wall Street. Other cities and states will also, to a lesser degree, have to learn how to make do with less, as tax revenues tumble. Similarly, retailers and service providers that serve the potentates of high finance can expect to be pinched, at least in the short term. However, all the talk of a depression or even a long, deep recession is entirely overblown. To understand why, just look at history and the state of the broader economy, which is based on real goods and services rather than credit default swaps and collateralized debt obligations. As George Friedman, president of the highly respected geopolitical consultancy Stratfor, observes, the financial services industry is gasping for survival. But the broader U.S. economy may not even be in a recession as traditionally defined. Until recently, at least, it has continued to grow at or near the post-World War II average. One reason is that to date, the Federal Reserve, the Treasury, and the FDIC have done a great job of protecting the broader economy. They have repeatedly rescued firms, such as AIG, whose failure might be catastrophic for Main Street. But at the same time, they have not intervened on behalf of firms such as Lehman Brothers, whose failures were judged to have manageable impacts. Because of this prudent action, we avoided the worst type of liquidity crisis. Unwillingness to lend to troubled firms, which we have seen, is not the same as a freezing up of liquidity. We've also been fortunate that plenty of companies have strong balance sheets, which eliminate the need for them to borrow at all. And many companies that do need to borrow have healthy balance sheets that make it relatively easy for them to secure financing. For Wall Street, the restructuring will require several years and tens of thousands of layoffs. But for the rest of the economy, it's simply a matter of coming to grips with the disappearance of a lot of paper assets that should never have existed in the first place. Friedman succinctly sums up the current situation in these words. It was terrible to be a mainframe computer manufacturer in the 1980s. It was awful to own an internet company in 1999, and it is terrible to be in the financial industry today. But, he adds, that is not the same as the collapse of civilization as we know it. As with every major crisis, this one presents us with many possibilities and many uncertainties. Conditions are changing so quickly that it's hard to fully understand the present, much less the future. However, those who position themselves to exploit future opportunities as they take shape will be tomorrow's big winners. With that in mind, we offer the following three forecasts for your consideration. First, greater regulation of the financial services industry is a certainty, and it will encourage a new, more prudent culture to take root on Wall Street. For the industry, the challenge is to embrace two characteristics, outlined by Martin Wolf. One, it should have simple rules that don't punish innovation, but rather improve the financial system's operational quality. And two, institutions must finally learn that behavior that may be highly beneficial if undertaken by just one firm can be disastrous when practiced by firms generally. Financing housing with 100%+ loans is a perfect example. For the government, the key will be to avoid counterproductive regulatory schemes like Sarbanes-Oxley, under which the costs greatly outweigh any benefits. Second, after a painful readjustment, market mechanisms will recreate a new culture on Wall Street that rewards prudence over excessive risk-taking. The readjustment will involve four steps. One, letting inflated asset prices fall to realistic levels. 2. Unleveraging an overborrowed private sector. 3. Recognizing the magnitude of the financial sector losses. And 4. Recapitalizing the financial system. To be viable, the new culture must avoid irresponsible compensation schemes and introduce better internal control systems that will prevent indefensible short-term decisions with enormous long-term consequences. And 3. One certainty is that human nature won't change. In 10 to 20 years, people will forget these lessons and a new once-in-a-lifetime crisis will shake the global financial structure.